Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. When an 11-year-old James Renner fell in love with Amy Mihaljevic, the missing girl seen on posters all over his neighborhood, it was the beginning of a lifelong obsession with true crime. That obsession leads James to a successful career as an investigative journalist. It also gave him PTSD. In 2011, James began researching the strange disappearance of Maura Murray, a University of Mass student who went missing after wrecking her car in rural New Hampshire in 2004. Over the course of his investigation, he uncovers numerous important and shocking new clues about what may have happened to Maura, but also finds himself in increasingly dangerous situations with little regard for his own well-being. As his quest to find Maura deepens, the case starts taking a toll on his personal life, which begins to spiral out of control. The result is an absorbing dual investigation of the complicated story of the all-American girl who went missing and James' own equally complicated true crime addiction. James Renner's True Crime Addict is the story of his spellbinding investigation of the missing persons case of Maura Murray, which has taken on a life of its own for armchair sleuths across the web. In the spirit of David Fincher's Zodiac, it is a fascinating look at a case that has eluded authorities and one man's obsessive quest for answers. The book that we're featuring this evening is True Crime Addict, How I Lost Myself in the Mysterious Disappearance of Maura Murray. With my special guest, journalist and author James Renner. Welcome to the program and thank you for agreeing to this interview, James Renner.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Welcome to the program, James. Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks for having me. Thanks a lot. This is a lot of fun. Thank you.
Now, let's start with giving the audience your background, because I think it's very important to this story, obviously, as the audience will discover. Tell us what your background is in true crime. We alluded to it with the story of Amy. So tell us a little bit about your investigative journalism background, which will be important to this story.
Sure. I was a journalist, a reporter for Cleveland Scene, which is the Village Voice-like newspaper in Cleveland, for about 7-8 years. And I kind of became the true crime guy in Cleveland at a time where we had a few active serial killers in town that you might have heard of, Anthony Sowell and Ariel Castro. And I actually started writing crime. One of the first stories I pitched was I wanted to take a new look at the cold case of Amy Mihaljevic. Now, Amy was 10 years old when she was abducted across the street from the Bay Village Police Department. And Bay Village is a western suburb of Cleveland, very affluent. It's where the a lot of the FBI agents raised their own families. Now, this little girl was abducted broad daylight on a Friday afternoon in late October, October 27th, 1989. Like I said, right across from the police station, there's a little shopping plaza there. And Amy and I are actually the same age. We were both born in 1978. And at the time she was in fifth grade, I was in sixth grade, and my mother lived in Rocky River, which was one town over. So this case had a huge impact on me as a kid. And I remember seeing her missing posters all over, every telephone pole around Cleveland in 1989. And when I saw that picture, the first thing that struck me is, oh, she's you know, she's really cute. You know, if she was in my sixth grade class, I'd be passing notes to her, you know, behind Miss Klein's back, right? And, you know, so I, for many reasons, I developed this this odd obsession, this even back then when I was 11 years old. I would get on my bike and I would ride to this mall. It's called Westgate Mall, kind of near Bay Village. And I figured this was the place where the most people were at any given time. And I would look for Amy in the crowds, thinking, well, maybe whoever took her brought her back, or maybe she got away and, you know, this is where she would go. And, of course, when they found her body a couple months later, you know, I would still continue to go there looking for her, the face of her abductor in the crowds. And so it was a very weird hobby for an 11-year-old to have, right? And as an adult now, looking back at that, you know, I through the course of writing this book on Laura Murray, this true crime addict, I had to ask myself, well, why did I gravitate towards that at 11 years old? Why was I trying to find her killer? And you know, I kind of explored that a little bit as I'm exploring the disappearance of Laura Murray in the book. So the book is very personal. It's very memoir. At the same time, it's very much about the disappearance of Laura Murray and where that case stands today.
Now, you, as I mentioned in the opening, you didn't get involved till 2011, so we're talking about 7 years after the crime. What was the state of the Murray family itself in terms of their efforts to have a website or something dedicated to the still the slim hope that she was alive and well? So what was the state at that time, 7 years later, and what did you learn from, say, the websites at that time? What did you sort of, your general knowledge over and beyond of based on some of the stuff that's been posted by the family at that time or during that time?
Sure. So I actually got involved with researching the case, I'd say back in 2010, you know, so yeah, at least 6 years on. And when I started to get involved and I started my research, everything had gone quiet. It was a very cold case. And the way it was presented at the time was that Maura Murray was this all-American girl, perfect to a fault, former West Point cadet, nothing but good grades, sky's the limit. This was going to be somebody who's going to do great things. And she disappeared, you know, and in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. Now, the family were no longer actively searching for her. You know, they had done these searches back in 2004 after she went missing. So, you know, the state of the case was very, it was very quiet. There's an official family webpage run by somebody that had, you know, a kind of a woman who's not blood related, but had married into the Murray family. She had never met Maura, but she had, that's not so uncommon. You know, a lot of times, you know, families need a little bit of a separation between the public and what's going on behind the scenes. So it made sense that she was running the official page. But that was really it. And the reason I was attracted to the Maura Murray mystery was I was looking for a national story to work on. I had I was no longer working for Scene. I was looking to write another true crime book. I had already written a couple. But I wanted to do something national, something bigger. And I was sitting at home one day, and the 2020 special came on. It was a special about Maura Murray's disappearance and also the disappearance of Brooke Wilberger, which has since been solved. Something about Maura Murray's case struck me as particularly unusual and different. And it's the fact that Maura Murray's case is actually a bit of a double mystery. There's two mysteries going on here. And just a real quick summary, Maura Murray was 22. She was a student at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She was studying nursing. On a Monday in February, she emailed her professors and said, there's been a death in the family, hold my work, I'll be in at the end of the week. And then she empties her bank account, only to the tune of about $280, gets into her car, drives hours north into the White Mountains of New Hampshire. Around 7:30 that night, her car impacts the snowbank on the side of a wild Amanusic Road, Route 112 up there. Sometime between the accident and the first responding officer, it was, we're talking like maybe 7 minutes, and it could be as few as 3 minutes between the accident and police arrived. Somewhere in that time frame, she vanished, never to be seen again. And, you know, what makes it a double mystery, right, is the first mystery is what happened to Maura Murray? The second mystery is what was she doing in the White Mountains to begin with? Why did she lie to her professors? Where was she going? And I figure if I could figure out the answer to that question, we'd get a lot closer to the answer to what happened to her to begin with. So it seemed like the odds were in my favor. I could at least solve, you know, one of those questions. And so I devoted the next 5-6 years of my life to research and writing this book. And I do believe I've answered the question as to what she was doing up there.
Now, before you undertake this, for all the, and again, we talked about all the amateur sleuths that were, that you used, you used their assistance, you mm-hmm. relied on a lot of the postings for information, and then one contact led to another, so you did use social media for that purpose. Tell us the other techniques that you embarked upon that you had used before, but you were especially going to need in this case to be able to fully research this. And so tell us a couple of the things that you used,
sure.
that you employed to be able to do this research.
Sure. Well, yeah, like you said, the first thing I did was I started a blog devoted to the case because I had already had a blog running devoted to Amy Mihaljevic case. And what I discovered is you can build a really decent blog with detailed information on the cold case. It kind of becomes a lightning rod for new information and clues. So, for instance, with Amy's case, you know, some of her old classmates would Google her name wondering what ever happened to this case, and they would be directed to my blog. And then if they had information to share, they could easily contact me with an email. So, and even, you know, you'd be surprised with the Amy Mihaljevic case, I was contacted by suspects, I was contacted by people who had new information that they didn't feel comfortable sharing with the police because they have shady backgrounds themselves, but they would share with me, and then I would be a liaison between that information and the police. So it works very well. So that's what I did with Maura's case, and sure enough, a lot of these armchair sleuths came forward and helped direct me to new avenues of investigation. And even people that knew Maura from West Point or UMass were able to contact me through the website, too, so it was very helpful. You know, other methods that I used, you know, go back to when I was a journalist, and I've learned, you know, that sometimes it helps to go on these fishing expeditions. At least that's what we call them, where we send out public records requests to every jurisdiction that this person has ever lived or spent time in. And that's what I did, and that's how I discovered the police records that showed that at the time that she disappeared, Maura Murray was in trouble for credit card fraud and identity theft. And so these other layers, more showing the complicated person that she was, started to appear. You know, she had stolen credit cards from other women in her dorm and used those credit card numbers and that person's name to order food. So nothing huge, but, I mean, that's kind of a big deal, you know, at the same time. The judge said if she could stay out of trouble for 6 months, that would wipe off her record. Now, I don't know that she was able to stay out of trouble, though. A couple days before she disappeared, she was driving her father's car back to his motel room. He had visited her on campus at 3:00 in the morning, and she ran into a guardrail. And it appears she was probably going to be charged with, at the very least, reckless operation for that. And I think she realized that her nursing career was kind of over. This credit card charge might be coming back to bite her in the ass. And she, I think that was one of the many reasons she had to leave and start a new life, because that's what I think happened here. I think I feel and think and I hope at the very least, but I think the evidence points to Maura Murray having the motive, means, and opportunity to leave and start a new life someplace.
Okay, we have to go backwards. We haven't
sure.
mentioned mm-hmm. the actual disappearance itself, and then we talked about a gentleman named Atwood and the tow truck driver and other witnesses
sure.
that obviously that come up in your investigation. But in your investigation also, and as in your book, you paint a very vivid portrayal of this woman. Again, we talked about West Point, which is no mean feat. So let's talk about Maura Murray, who, at least by her achievement, she was. And then through your investigation, there seems to be a little, again, a little crack in the veneer here in terms of this all-perfect, all-American woman. However, again, nothing too serious, but again, it's interesting, your investigation. So tell us, in your investigation, tell us about Maura Murray, her father, Fred. Tell us about her mother. Tell us about her early life, what you found.
Sure. So Maura Murray grew up in Hanson, Massachusetts, which is it's about 45 minutes south of Boston, close enough to the city that you can get there, close enough to the ocean that you can get there quickly. It's a town of Cranberry Bogs. It's where Ocean Spray got its start. It's a nice, quaint little safe suburb of Boston, of greater Boston anyways. And it reminds me a lot of the hometown I grew up in here in Ohio. You know, all the families kind of knew each other. She lived on Joanne Drive, which is a little bit of a cul-de-sac, but it's even a safe little street. Everybody knows each other's business out there. Maura was the second youngest in the family. So there was her father, Fred, her mother, Lori. There's Fred Jr., there's Kathleen Murray, the oldest daughter, Julie Murray, and then you've got Maura and a younger brother, Kurt. And it was after the younger brother, Kurt, came along that her parents separated, and Fred moved to Weymouth and lived in an old house there, while Maura stayed with her siblings and her mother in Hanson. Now, her father was very involved with her life, even after the separation. He would come down very strict, very controlling. He would condition his daughters into star runners and star athletes. And I say they conditioned every day. You talk to the neighbors and friends there, they said, yes, you know, you'd see Maura and Julie running on Christmas morning with Fred, you know, shouting behind them, you know, or urging right. them on. So they became star athletes in high school track and field and cross country. Julie was first, and she was fast. Now, Maura came up a year after Julie, and she was faster, and she was better there for a little while. After graduation, Julie goes on to West Point, and then Maura follows her. And Julie ends up graduating West Point. Maura lasts, I think it's three semesters, heading into her fourth when she leaves. Now, this is one of the stories that the family kind of, you know, well, her father specifically lies about at times. And you can kind of understand them and kind of not, you know, she's missing. Why are you lying about anything at this point? But the truth is Maura was about to be kicked out of West Point when she withdrew in the spring semester of her sophomore year to go to UMass Amherst and begin studying for nursing there. What happened at West Point was, and this took, you know, I'd heard rumors for a while, but it took a while to track down and speak to the people involved. She got in trouble for stealing from Fort Knox, of all places. Now, you know, if that's not a cry for help, I don't know what is, stealing from the most secure facility in the United States. But what she had stolen, again, we're talking small things in big situations. She stole makeup from the commissary at Fort Knox, and she got caught, and she was brought up on, they have their own little judicial process within West Point, and, you know, they were going to recommend that she be expelled, and before that happened, she withdrew so that she didn't have that on her record. Now, during that process, that whole judiciary process, it's kind of interesting. She ends up meeting one of the fellow student liaisons with the Judicial Review Board, and his name's Bill Roush, and they end up having a relationship, and it's Bill Roush who you see in the early reports, and sometimes he's referred to as her fiancé, but they weren't quite engaged to be married. They had kind of promised to become engaged, but they hadn't quite made it that far. But Maura had spent that Christmas holiday with Belle and his family in Ohio a month before she disappeared in 2004. So they were pretty close. So that's kind of a quick overview of Maura. She was an overachiever in school. She came from a big family, although it was broken. There were troubles there. Her mother was an alcoholic. She ended up dying just a couple years after Maura disappeared. Actually, she died on Maura's birthday. It's a complicated family, a New England family, Catholic, a lapsed Catholic type of.
What was the status of the relationship with Bill Rausch? You say that they met, it was good relationship, and you say they weren't engaged, but was there any infidelity? Was she faithful? What could you determine? What did you determine through her girlfriends and your research?
Well, you talk to Maura's friends and family, and they're very candid about the fact that nobody really liked Bill Rausch. And the reason why the family at least didn't like Bill Rausch is because he cheated on Maura more than once. Now, it's interesting to note when Maura disappeared, the police eventually got into her dorm room and they found that all of her things, or most of her things, had been packed neatly into boxes. And on top of the boxes was a printed out email from Billy that Billy had sent to Maura. And in the email, he's talking about how he cheated on Maura, that almost seems like Maura saying kind of F you to Bill on the way out. That's one interpretation of it. Otherwise, why would you print that out and leave it on top of your boxes? But so Bill was cheating on her, but Maura was no angel at the same time. Maura had a lot of secrets, and one of those secrets was the fact that she was having an affair with one of the track coaches at UMass, this guy with the auspicious name of Hossein Baghdadi. And he goes by Haas. And Haas was a track coach, and Maura and her friend Kate Markopoulos would often get together with Haas for drinks or just to hang out after practice. Maura was no longer with the team, I think, at that point, but Maura and Haas had a very intimate relationship, and I spoke to him, and he was surprisingly candid about it, admitted it. He's like, yeah, we were really close for a long time, and he's the one that said, they would be lying in bed, and he said on a couple of times, Maura mentioned starting a new life and running away, and he always thought that she meant Mexico.
Now, with the relationship with her father, you've done some exploration here, and of course, his behavior after his daughter is missing is going to be much different than what happened immediately after she went missing, and then when you became involved in the investigation and tried to question him and the rest of the family. So tell us more about this phone call that she has at work. Apparently her supervisor comes by and then notifies the other supervisor. Tell us about this, and what do you think the significance, if any, about this phone call, which happens around this time as well?
Yeah, they say past is prologue. And if you look at the days leading up to Maura's disappearance, there's some strange behavior going on. And it all seems to start that Thursday night. She disappeared on a Monday. Now, if you go back to Thursday night, Maura's working the security desk. She had a job checking in IDs at Melville Hall, which is near her dorm. She was living at a Kennedy Hall in UMass. And so she'd sit at the desk checking in IDs, and she wasn't supposed to be talking on the phone, but she was talking on the phone that night. And there were a couple calls that came in, one from her sister Kathleen, her older sister Kathleen. And then there was a later call with Bill Rausch. Now, shortly after that second call, her supervisor, Karen Mayotte, visits and checks in on her and finds Maura, in her words, in a catatonic state. She was so upset she couldn't really talk. The only thing that she managed to say was, my sister. the supervisor was so concerned about her, she walked Maura back to her dorm, signed her off her shift, and even suggested Maura might need some mental health attention. Like, she kind of suggested she go to the hospital and check herself in. Maura assured her that she was okay, that, you know, she had a roommate, that she'd be fine. That was also a lie. Maura had a single. She didn't have a roommate in that dorm. So, you know, and then the next day, school was canceled because of weather. That was the Friday. So the supervisor thought, well, you know, good for her. She can sleep in and rest and get some needed relaxation time. So, and then you're into Saturday, and that's when Fred Murray shows up on campus. And there's some strange things about that. You know, he mentioned this before, where he says he was at, you know, why is the father on campus right before she disappears? Now, he says, bring her, find a new car. So he brought some money, he brought $4,000, and he makes a point to tell the police this later. I had $4,000 in cash on my person, he says, in his statement to police. And now, when you look into that $4,000, it gets a little strange, too, because in order to get that $4,000 in cash, Fred doesn't just, you know, he's not going to write a check to the place where he's looking for a car. And by the way, they never did get a new car for Maura that weekend. He doesn't withdraw it from his bank in one lump sum. On the way to UMass, he visits, I think, 8 different ATMs and withdraws $100 from each. It's a very strange way of getting that money. And if he truly got it, you know, I don't know. Everything about that's always been strange to me. So he's with Maura during the day on Saturday. There's a call. One of them called Reliance Auto, which is a used car. So they might have visited there. Kate Markopoulos, Julie's best friend at UMass, joins them for drinks at a brew pub later that night. Then Fred takes the girls to buy liquor, and the girls are planning to go to Sarah Alfieri. It's another friend of Maura's. Sarah Alfieri's holding a party in her dorm room. So they drop Fred off at his motel, and then they drive back to campus, and supposedly Kate and Maura then attend this party with Sarah Alfieri. Now, this party's been described as being standing room only. It was packed with people, but after Maura disappears, Kate can never remember who else was at that party. And Sarah's always been quiet. Sarah's never said anything about this to, at least to journalists, at least to, you know, the family. There's been a report that Sarah told, quote unquote, the real story to Fred once, and she was asked never to repeat it. So whatever she told, I don't know. But nobody can seem to remember what exactly happened at that party. All we know is that Maura leaves around 3 o'clock in the morning and decides to drive her father's car back to his motel room. And along the way, that's where she gets into her accident, the first accident at UMass, and drives the car into a guardrail. Tow truck comes. The police come. The police decline to charge her with DUI, although it looks like she's going to be cited for reckless op, a failure to control. The tow truck tows the car and brings Maura back to the motel where Fred is staying, and then she stays the night in this motel room. And then you're into Sunday. Fred drops her back off at the dorm. Then she goes radio silent for I think it's like 16 hours. And it's possible she left her cell phone at that party at Sarah Alfieri's place. That's one story I've been told, but there's no calls from her cell phone until, like, I think it's Monday morning or maybe late Saturday night. And then Monday she's gone. You know, Monday she leaves. So that's the days and events leading up to her disappearance.
Now, when you talked about the character of the father, we haven't really explored that as much as you do in the book. But if he was up there to help her buy a car and he took $4,000 of his own money, then it would seem that he was buying her a car, voluntarily, but maybe reluctantly or begrudgingly. And then during that time, he has a job that he has to travel a couple hours, so his vehicle is important to him. She goes to a party, mm-hmm. and she smacks up his car. So how disappointed do you think, which could add to the an element to the story, how disappointed do you think he would have been with her behavior involving cars and money and him being put out? And what do you think?
Yeah. So the only person that we can get that, you know, there's only two people who know what exactly went on in that motel room after Moore shows up with his broken car, and that's Fred and Maura. One of them's gone. And Fred's story about that changes. You know, in one story, you know, the one he told police, he wakes up and finds that Maura's in bed in the motel room, which is hard to believe because how did she get into the motel room to begin with? Maybe he gave her another key card or something. I don't know. The other version of that story that he told investigators, these are private investigators that were helping search in the White Mountains for Maura weeks after the disappearance, was that he was called to the front office of the motel, in the lobby, and Maura was passed out drunk on a couch. And then he woke her up and brought her back there. But, yeah, he's, you know, I imagine, you know, imagine this Irish lapsed Catholic from Southie Boston, you know, he's not pleased. So, yeah, I don't know how angry he was with her or how disappointed he made her feel, but it probably wasn't a good conversation. You know, it's hard getting the truth from Fred. You know, you get half truths, you get half stories. He's just never, you know, and when reporters pushed him on this, they're like, hey, man, help us try to find your daughter. Tell us what was happening in her life that might help us understand why she was going up to the White Mountains. And he would say, no, I'm not going to talk about that. Don't even ask me what I do for a living. It doesn't matter. All that matters is she disappeared in New Hampshire, and now we got to find her. Well, the best way of trying to find her is figuring out why she was up there in the first place. Fred never wanted to talk about that. It's weird. It's weird behavior from the father of a missing kid and a missing woman. You know, I've never seen it before. And I've done a lot of true crime. I certainly am well versed in many of the major crimes. And most times, parents of a missing child are doing everything they can to tell the media what was going on in their life. And we know everybody has skeletons in their closet. We know Maura's not perfect. But that doesn't matter. She's missing. You know, share the info so we can help find her. And it's not like he wasn't just doing that to journalists. He went down for a formal interview with the lead detectives in this case with the state police for 2.5 years after Maura went missing. And when he finally did, he brought two lawyers with him. So this is not typical behavior. And I'm at a loss to explain it. I really don't know. Because ultimately, I don't think Fred was involved with what happened to Maura that night that she went missing. But I certainly think he knows more than he's ever shared.
Let's talk about the actual event and the disappearance, and then let's talk about, to be fair, again, you say odd behavior, but it's not like the father doesn't search for his daughter. But you talked to somebody mm-hmm. that named Tim that outlined that was very close to that. So let's first talk about the event itself, and then let's talk about the search.
Again, so Maura gets up to the White Mountains at about 7:30 that night, which is interesting because if you look at the time she took out her money from the ATM at UMass and figure that she left shortly thereafter for this drive, there's about 45 minutes that are unaccounted for. That, you know, if she had driven straight up to where she got into an accident, the accident should have happened about 45 minutes earlier than it did. So what was she doing? Did she meet somebody somewhere? Did she stop to eat? We don't know. But anyways, about 7:30 at night, her car runs into a snowbank on the side of Route 112 near the town of Haverhill, New Hampshire. And the first person on the scene is actually a bus driver who gets there like a couple seconds after the accident happens. And his name's Butch Atwood, and he's like this 300-pound, white handlebar mustache-looking country dude of a guy, and very imposing. But he's driving a school bus. He's got this tender heart at the same time, and he stops and he asks Maura if she needs help. And she says, no, 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 I've already called AAA. Don't worry about it. And he knows that she's lying, because even to this day, you can't get cell phone service up there. So he's like, well, all right. So if you need a ride? And she's like, no, she declines. And she says, and please don't call the police. Well, you know, he knows better. So he pulls into his driveway, and he can see, he lives right there across the street, basically. And he can kind of still see the accident scene. And he goes and tells his wife what happened. And she calls the police immediately, of course. And so that's one of the calls. Now, there was another call right after the accident by Faith Westman, who lived right across the street from where this accident occurred. And it occurred at this, like, almost 90-degree turn in the road by this old weathered barn. There's accidents there all the time in the winter. There were snowbanks that were, like, 5 feet high on either side. And it's very easy to come along that turn and lose control. And that's where she got in an accident. So Faith Westman lives right there at that turn. And she hears the accident. She calls in the police, too. And there's another house on the same side of the street where Maura crashes that can also see the accident. So you've got three pairs of eyes that are kind of, you know, I always picture them as like beams from a lighthouse. And they're, you know, they'll check the accident scene. They'll see Maura sitting in the car, and then she gets out. And she opens the trunk, and she's fiddling with something back there for a little bit. And these beam of lights kind of illuminate the scene and then turn away when they, you know, get bored or they go to do other things in the house. So there were moments there where she wasn't being watched, but not for very long. Sometime in there, she disappears before the police show up. And so that's the scene of the accident there. And you have to wonder what happened to her. You know, did she, you know, what are the possibilities? Number one, maybe she got scared and ran into the woods to hide. We know that's not true because they started the search. They were up. I spoke to the guy, Sergeant Scarinza, Lieutenant Scarinza, who was in charge of the investigation for the first, like, 5 or 6 years. Now, he was up in a helicopter about 36 hours after the disappearance. It had not snowed again since Maura disappeared. It was ideal conditions for seeing things from the air. He was able to see footprints of a fox and follow it back to where the fox was at in the woods. That's how detailed he could see. And there were no footprints leading anywhere near the crash site into the woods. So she didn't go into the woods. So did she, was she abducted? You know, was she abducted from the side of the road? And it's a very sexy thought. It's, you know, what we think of when we watch CSI or something like that. But in order for that to happen, consider the astronomical, you know, probability against it. There would have to be a serial killer coincidentally driving down that road at that exact moment. At that time of night, at that time of year, they've counted the number of cars that pass by that place within an hour. And there's seven. On average, there's seven people that drive by that scene at that time of night on that day. And one of those people, to be a serial killer, it's beyond reason. So, and then you'd have to assume that they were able to get her into the car against her will and get away from the scene without being seen by any of those people that are watching the accident scene. And it's just, remember, we're dealing with a former West Point cadet. She's not going to go quietly. It would not have been quickly. So it can't be a messy abduction. She was traveling in tandem with another driver, a friend or a family member, somebody she knew and trusted. They were driving in a vehicle in front of her. She gets into an accident. The other vehicle sees this or sees that she's no longer following. They turn around and pick her up. Now, that transaction, that interaction could have been quick, could have been 5 seconds. They slow down, Maura hops in the car, go, 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 they're gone. That could account for why nobody sees it happen, because it was so quick. And the only way for it to be quick is if she knew the person. So that's kind of where I eventually ended up, is believing that this had to have been a tandem drive. There's other evidence to support this too. One of the last things she does before leaving UMass, the police discover, is that she was doing searches on her computer for condos. And she actually she called a condo in New Hampshire and contacted them about rooms. And the rooms that she was searching for were not single rooms. They were actually units that had at least two bedrooms. So she wasn't looking for a place just for herself. She was looking for a place big enough to accommodate at least two people, maybe more.
Now, a big part of this book is that you have a hard time, in one way, trying to get some answers, and you, again, are surprised that and shocked by the reaction by Fred, especially the father, but a lot of the rest of the family and friends, like there's some super dark secret that nobody wants to, you know, to reveal. So tell us who was one of the big, or your first breakthrough in terms of getting information that was very, very useful and led to the next bit of information.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm trying to think what my first big break was, probably speaking to her supervisor, the woman that found her catatonic, you know, at the desk at Melville that night. And that was my first interview with somebody directly related to the mystery of what happened to Maura. You know, hearing her describe Maura, hearing somebody talk about Maura who had known her and known her well, was very interesting, and that definitely got the ball rolling, because I shared that interview on my blog, and it allowed more people to see what I was doing, and then they would come forward and speak. The other big break was speaking and sitting down with Lieutenant Scorenza, who was in charge of the investigation. He was a lieutenant with the state police in New Hampshire, and again, he's the guy up in the helicopter, too, 36 hours after she disappeared. I sat down with Scorenza for a couple of hours one day. It was one of my first interviews, and, you know, he's the one that, you know, he explained to me the difficulty they had with talking to Fred and how, you know, he wasn't very helpful, and then he was very antagonistic, actually. He ended up suing the state of New Hampshire and the police to try to get more information. But another thing that came out of that conversation with Scorenza was that Scorenza believes that Maura was pregnant when she disappeared. They did a search of her computer, and they found that in the days leading up to her disappearance, Maura was searching for information on the effects of drinking and being pregnant, you know, whether or not that could hurt the baby. So I think he's probably right. I mean, that would be one very good reason to stay hidden after all this attention, is if you're dealing with a child, is if she was pregnant and she did have a kid, and maybe this is a kid that she doesn't ever want to worry about custody or sharing custody with the father. So that to me is a heck of a motive to stay hidden.
What's interesting is that the police must believe that there's some, well, maybe you can tell us what you think the police believe, what their theory of this whole thing is, but regardless, you're talking about 80 troopers, helicopters, we're talking about a massive search here. And when I talked about that big break, what I'm talking about is when you got a chance to speak to Tim, and this is a little bit later on, tell me what this gentleman, Tim, how had the ability to be privy to this conversation or these conversations, and then tell us about the searches that were conducted with Fred.
Sure.
And
yeah,
just the impression that Tim had.
Yeah, so in the media, you know, you read about Fred and you see him as this man who's out to find his daughter at all costs, and he's out there walking through the woods and, every weekend after her disappearance, ready to find her, doing everything it takes to find her. Now, who you're talking about is a fellow by the name of Tim Carpenter, and he was a very big interview. Tim was married to Kathleen Murray, that's Moore's oldest sister. He was married to her for a number of years and was married to her when Moore disappeared. I tracked him down and he talked to me for a little while, and the things he said put a new slant on everything, a new light. And, he would talk about, he was there for the searches. He would go out there on the weekends. And what he says is that Fred would put on a certain appearance when the media was there, and he'd be very different when the reporters and the cameras were not there. And yes, he would be up there on the weekends, but he would sleep in. When he'd get up, everybody's like, all right, let's go. All these volunteers, they're like, let's go look for Maura. But he wouldn't be ready. He'd sleep in, and then he'd go for a run, and then he'd take a shower, and then he'd start the day, and he'd give them leads, and he'd say, okay, you go look here, you go look here, you go look here. And they'd go up for an hour or so, and then they'd come back and have lunch. And then they'd go off again. And then they'd break a short time after that, and everybody would go back to the pub and start drinking and then roll into the next day where he's sleeping in. So, but when the reporter showed up, when the camera showed up, Fred was, front and center and in the woods and searching and relentless. But that is not the Fred that Tim Carpenter described existed when cameras were not there. So there's weird behavior again there. And, Tim said that, there was a very different side of the family, kind of a darker side. And, specifically with Kathleen, he was married to Kathleen for a while. And, Kathleen ends up getting in trouble. She's in and out of rehab. She ends up getting pulled over for a DUI, blows a .35. Now, I've never heard of anybody with that high of a blood alcohol content. With a .35, we're talking about, I'm like 180 pounds, 5'10". If I were to drink that, I could die. You look up the effects of this. Now, Kathleen's a little bigger. But still, we're talking beyond the point of blackout drunk. If you're drinking that much, you are self-medicating, I know from self-medicating, I'm a recovering alcoholic myself. I know how it works. And that's self-medicating behavior. You're getting drunk because you don't want to think about certain things. So, there's a family with secrets, a family with trouble, and Tim opened up a door into that, and it gives a better look of, it suggests that there might have been other things that Maura was running away from. I think she was getting away from her family. I think she was unhappy with that, that part of her life. I think she wanted to get away from her father. I think she wanted to get away from her boyfriend, Bill. And, she finally was pushed to the point where she was either going to break or she was going to go. And I think she went. I think she took off and didn't look back.
What was your research in terms of the likelihood of suicide? Did the police have that idea? Did any of the people, the commenters, the people following this case, did they think maybe she went up to the mountains to kill herself? What did you find?
Well,
was she...
it's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting. The first person to suggest suicide is actually Fred Murray, her father. When they finally get in touch with him after they realize that Moore is missing, the first thing he says to the police is, oh, my gosh, I bet you went up to Mount Washington on an old squaw walk. Fred says the weirdest things. It's like the things that he says are only things you would read in like a weird book or see on TV. They're bad lines. And that was one of them, the old squaw walk. And what he means is this old idea that, in Native American cultures, when the woman, was beyond her use, when she didn't feel she could contribute anything, she would walk into the woods and die. And so he's assuming that that's what Maura did. So why does Fred believe that she's so upset that his daughter would commit suicide? What happened that he would think that she could do that? And I've never believed in the suicide theory for a couple reasons, but the biggest is that's a long way to go to commit suicide. If she was going to commit suicide, why not just do it at UMass? You know, why, you know, her gas tank is full when she gets into the accident. This is, you know, and her car is packed with a lot of stuff. This is not a person who has checked off everything, who, you know, is just going up there to commit suicide. And if she did, where's the body, you know? It's wooded, yet people will say, wow, that's the wilderness. You know, of course, she could have died there. Nobody would ever find her body. That's not entirely true. We know she didn't walk into the woods. There were no footprints, no signs that she'd walked away from the car. But let's say she did. She got up there. I think by now hikers would have found her body, but I think they would have found her in the searches. There were two massive searches that were conducted by the Fish and Game Department. We're talking hundreds of volunteers. The area around where she disappeared was searched thoroughly within like a 5-mile radius. She didn't commit suicide.
What about, obviously you're going to check her ATM, her bank card for activity. What was that check like? What did that uncover? And then we can talk about Billy,
yeah.
And is he cleared in terms of alibi?
Well, so the first question is, you know, the bank stuff. And there's some interesting things with the banks. She, like I said, she had essentially emptied her account as much as she could. I think there was like $8 left in her account or something. Now, her father, remember that $4,000 he has on him or says he does when Maura goes
right.
missing? Comes from the family spokesperson, this Helena Dwyer Murray, who runs the message board. A couple months ago on Facebook, she explained that because people started asking, well, what did he do with that $4,000 after Maura disappeared? Or is it possible that Maura took that money? And she came forward and said, well, Fred put it into an account that Maura had access to, specifically to see if Maura was missing and she needed money, she could access it. But they say that account was never touched again.
Right.
Now, there's also, I was contacted through the website by somebody that worked with Citizens Bank, and you know they did this before they contacted me, but they did something that was probably not entirely legal, which on their spare time they would look up people, like kind of famous people's accounts, out of curiosity. And I verified this person did work for Citizens Bank, by the way. And she says, and I passed this along to the cold case unit even, she says at the time of Maura's, this was 2 years after Maura disappeared that she searched this. She said there was an active account for a car loan under Maura's name using Maura's date of birth and Social Security number. That was taken out in the state of New Hampshire, and it was being paid. It was current, which means somebody was paying it on a monthly basis. So that's really strange too. So that's the interesting bank information. And then you asked about Bill Rausch's alibi. And at first, I always figured Bill was above suspicion. And then, you know, at the 11th hour, right before the book was due to go to the, to be laid out and we couldn't fiddle with it anymore, some information came in about Bill and by four different women who worked with him at a place called Rig Group International in D.C., and they handled contracts with the VA. Bill was working for them back in 2011. And these women claim, and I spoke to the woman directly involved, claim that he assaulted a female co-worker on St. Patrick's Day, after work. This woman came back to the office. She says that he asked her to come into the president's office and then closed and locked the door behind her and proceeded to push up against her and then turn around, push her face down into a table, and then push his body up against behind her. Another worker came in at that point, and this girl was able to get away. This woman was able to get away from him. And, you know, that was after he said, don't you say anything about this. And he ended up leaving. I spoke to Bill about this. He acknowledges that these allegations, that he had heard these allegations, and that he left that job. He never came back after that day. And he no longer, of course, lists that job on LinkedIn or anything like that. So he ends up, you know, not working there anymore after they do an internal review. The woman goes to police. She ultimately decides not to press charges, I think, worried what impact that might have on her career in D.C. So anyways, that led me to take a real hard look at Bill again. And eventually I was able to obtain his cell phone records for the days before, leading up to, and after Moore's disappearance. And it, you know, 99.9% sure that it puts him where he says he was, which is Fort Sill, Oklahoma, which is like 1,000 miles away from New Hampshire. We're talking about a 12-hour longer, I think like a 20-hour drive. So, but he was in the field. You know, he's using his cell phone. It seems as though he's calling a lot of Fort Sill numbers. You know, I can't say without a doubt. You know, but I would say he's got a pretty solid alibi, you know, for when Moore disappeared.
Now, you had some luck with some people, and you had some leads that turned into things that it seemed like, you describe it as a rabbit hole. But there's some things that lead to not conclusions, and then other things that seem to support the idea you already had that she may have ran away. Let's talk about Dick Guy and the EMS guy and what he had said about the crash itself and what you got from it. How was that significant for you? What did that tell you or lead you to believe?
Yeah, so when you go up to the accident scene and take a look at where this happened, you're at this, she's heading east down Route 112, and she comes to this like almost 90-degree turn in the road, but her car ends up facing west on the southern side of the road. So she ends up completely turned around on the lane that she had been driving in, if you can picture that. And the official police report says that she ended up in that situation because she struck a tree. Now, that doesn't make sense. First of all, there's no trees right there. She would have had to have, remember, there's like 5-foot tall snowbanks. She would have had to, you know, jump over the snowbank, hit a tree, and then come back. It just doesn't work with physics. You know, it was a badly reported, you know, accident scene. So, through the reports, and I find that there were a number of other people at the accident scene that night, some EMT, volunteer EMTs. One of them was this guy, Dick Guy, the TV guy. He runs this TV repair business in Woodsville, next door to Haverhill. And I went to his shop, and I talked to him one day, and he had a better explanation for how she got in that accident. And he drew a little diagram for me to explain it, but he believes, he was there that night, and he said, so you've got that turn, and on the north side of the road, there's this, you know, essentially a corner, and there's a snowbank there, but it was somebody had sheared it off, and he thinks that she had actually crossed the double lane, the double yellow lines, and impacted the north side of the road. So she's heading east, she crosses the lanes at the turn, smacks into the corner, shears off that snowbank, and that force, that impact and force, flips her car around and sends it back into the lane she was in. And that works a lot better, in my mind, than the official explanation in the police report. So, and it explains the damage done to the car, why the front left part of the hood is pushed down, and the crack in the windshield, the airbags were deployed. I think she impacted that snowbank just like Dick Guy said.
What's the significance of the tow truck driver? And tell us about what he said he saw in the tailpipe, and what is your conclusion? What was his conclusion?
This is the one clue that nobody can quite make heads or tails of. The tow truck driver, his name was Mike Lavoy, and he is called by the police. They said, hey, come down here and pick up this car, take it. And he takes it back to not his shop, but his home. It's like after hours, so it kind of makes sense. He tows Moore's Saturn back to his house and then puts it in his garage, which has a lock in it. At the time, the police, they're not treating it yet as a missing persons case. They think what they're dealing with is a DUI that walked away, and they've seen that type of thing a lot. And there was evidence that Moore had been drinking in the car. There was spilled wine that they could see inside, and it smelled like booze. So they think that, somebody got drunk and crashed into the snowbank. They'll probably be back in the morning hungover looking for their car. So Lavoy tows it back to his place, and then he notices that there's like a rag stuck in her tailpipe. And so that's weird, because the first thing you think, at least in my mind, when you think rag in a tailpipe is, some people think suicide. Other people think, did somebody put it in there so that her car would stall? You know, did the car stall at that turn? Is that what caused the accident? I'm a father myself now. I've got two kids. Now, God forbid they go missing. And I'm in this situation, and I'm her father, and I come to town, and I hear that my daughter's missing, and there's this rag stuck in the tailpipe. Well, I'm going to use that clue to get the police to really investigate this, because it seems like somebody wanted her car to stall. That's not what Fred Murray does. When he sees that rag in the tailpipe, he explains it away. And he says, her exhaust was smoking, and I told her to put a rag up in the tailpipe so she didn't get in trouble for the exhaust smoking. Now, either that's true, and he gave her really, really bad advice about how to take care of a smoky exhaust, or it's not true, and to wonder why he's trying to explain away that detail. Is it because he makes a point to say that he got her that rag, and that it's tested? You know, that would explain why his fingerprints are on it, if they ever test it. I don't know, but as a father, I'm not going to explain away that bit of very important evidence. I don't know what to make of it. I don't know what to make of the rag and the tailpipe. It's a weird piece of this whole thing.
Now let's get to how you come to believe that she may have tried to run away from her life. Who leads you to that decision, that conclusion? Tell us how you come to that decision, and then what do you plan to do as a result?
Yeah, well, so what's the motive for running away? You know, and to me, it started to become clear when I learned a little bit more about Fred's background and behavior, and about Bill's background and behavior. And we have a guy who, you know, lost his job over allegations of assaulting a woman in a strange way in the office. And I spoke to high school girlfriends who said that they weren't surprised to hear that. He had a reputation for being rough back then. Now, if he's rough with women before Maura and rough with women after them, I can only wonder what it was like with Maura. Certainly her friends and family didn't like this guy. He was cheating on her. The chief of police in Haverhill at the time was a guy named, Cecil Smith. And Cecil, you know, very peaceful guy, very nice guy. The only time I ever saw him angry was when I asked him about Bill. And he said, if, you know, whatever happened to Maura up in New Hampshire was, whether or not Bill was directly involved, it was his fault. Guy is an a-hole, you know. And so he was furious with this guy. So she had, and then add to that these legal troubles. I think she realized she was never going to be a nurse. The police believed she was pregnant, so there was a lot of motives for her to run away and start fresh somewhere with maybe with this kid. And, you know, so how did she do that? Did she go on her you know, did she go on her own with maybe help from a friend or two? Another way she could have gone about that is utilizing some of these really interesting abused women resources, where there are places that it works almost like the witness protection program, but better, and it's for abused women. And, you know, it's kind of like this underground railroad that's not talked about too much that will help women find a new home, find a new identity, find a new life, and set them up, but they have to leave their old life behind. And it's interesting, but that really does happen. And, you know, these other women that are involved in the organization will loan these abused women their social security number until they're set up with a new one, so that they can fly completely under the radar.
Now, you talk about sort of like a witness protection. What better thing to do than to disappear right out of your own country? And how is it that you think that she may have gone to Canada? Tell us what makes you believe that.
Well, there's a couple things that point to Canada, although I would not be surprised if Maura Murray is still living in New Hampshire. You know, I would not be surprised that she's still in the New England area somewhere. But there were these rumors early on that Maura was spotted in Canada. There were a couple posts on message boards, one purportedly by a classmate of Maura's who was visiting a town called Sherbrooke in Canada, which is not too far away from, you know, where she went missing, a couple hours drive north, but past the border. And they said that they had seen Maura and said, you know, called out to her, said, "Hey, Maura," and she turned and, you know, looked really shocked and then walked away and said she was with this, you know, handsome young man and seemed happy. And there were a couple other reports like that and message boards. And eventually, you know, I and a couple, you know, Lance and Tim, who do the podcast and they're working on a documentary on the case, we all drove up to try to see what we could do and see if we could find her maybe. This was back, I think, in 2013. And we visited Sherbrooke, we visited Montreal, and we visited Quebec City. And there were a couple places that we would show her picture. There's a coffee shop in, I think it was in Montreal that we visited, where we showed her picture, and the person that worked there was adamant. She's like, "Yeah, she was in here like a couple of days ago. You know, I know this woman." And we showed her a picture at a gym, you know, because Maura was always very athletic and thought maybe those would be good places to check out. So we showed her a picture at this gym, and the woman behind the counter, again, she was adamant. She's like, "Yes, I know this person. She was in here not too long ago. Absolutely." So, but, you know, could they be mistaken? Could they be thinking another brunette? I don't know. But to me, there were some really decent sightings in Canada. And it's either a look-alike or, you know, or it's Maura.
Now, you have this very interesting clue, and again, you have these leads that seem to go not so far and then just seem to be more perplexing than anything else, not so conclusionary. Tell us what you find with a place, and if I'm pronouncing it wrong, Saco, Maine, and Rick Graves.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's one of those weird things, like so many strange things about this case, but so I've got a friend who's a private investigator here in Cleveland. His name's Mike Lewis, and he's helped me out now and again through his business, Confidential Investigations, and they're kind of the premier private eyes for the greater Cleveland area. And I asked him to run Maura's background, and what that'll do is kind of run her social security number too and see if anything's come up. And when he did that, something odd happened where it showed that her social security number was attached to this address in Saco, Maine, this town, S-A-C-O, Saco or Saco, Maine. Very kind of rural place, odd place for her social security number to connect to. And it was connected after her disappearance. So, you know, my first thought was, well, is that where she's living? Is that where she's hiding? I don't know. And it was when I went to speak to Tim Carpenter, you know, I said, you know, because Tim was and Kathleen Moore's sister were involved in the searches for Moore, you know, in the weeks after she disappeared. And so I asked him, I said, can you get me in touch with any of the other volunteers who were helping to look for Moore back then? And he said, sure. He's like, you know who you should talk to is this guy Rick Graves. He was all about trying to find Moore, and, you know, we didn't really know who he was, but he wanted to offer his time. And I said, sure, you know, and he gave me his number, and I said, oh, this is a weird prefix. Isn't this Maine? And he said, yeah. And so where's Rick Graves live? And he said, oh, Saco, Maine. So that was I was like, oh, my gosh, you know, could this, you know, what's going on here? You know, how is this working? And what I ended up learning was that Fred's Moore's father, he gave this Rick Graves permission to put some sort of tracker on Moore's social security number. So he gave this guy Moore's social, and he used it, you know, on some programs. And that's why, you know, to this day, her social security number dings with his address if you look for it. So that's the connection. At first it seemed really promising, like maybe I could drive there and, you know, she'd answer the door. But it quickly became apparent that it was connected to this volunteer who helped search for her. And he's a good guy. I've talked to him, and I'd say he's above suspicion. He's as confused about the whole thing as everybody else, and very confused about the way Fred acted the whole time as well.
To be fair, though, he doesn't act like a killer or anything, because he does really do the kinds of things that a father would do. You mention in the book, or you talk about in the book, that it looks like he doesn't care. He sleeps late. He gets up late. Then it turns into sort of a party atmosphere after the search that day, after 7 or 8 hours of search. But he did do things like get Graves to put this tracker on her card. So he did things that aren't indicative of somebody guilty of foul play involving his daughter. Is it?
Yeah, I'm not suggesting Fred did anything like that. At most, I'm suggesting that Fred knows more about why Moore wanted to disappear and why Moore wanted to run away than he's ever said. I think Fred would like to find her. I don't think Moore wants Fred to find her. I think there's all sorts of explanations that you could come up with as to why Fred acted the way he does. But, you know, it just, nothing he did ever rang true to me, you know, and I've spoken to, I've met with the fathers of missing women, of missing children, and it's not a part of the course. This is a strange individual. I think back to the Amy Mihaljevic case, and I've certainly been on the outs with Amy's family over the things that I've reported. I mean, there's some things they don't particularly care that I shared, you know, the fact that her parents were planning to get divorced at the time that Amy was abducted, and, you know, whether that played into everything, you know, but her father always talked to me, and always was happy that I was getting his daughter's name out there, and was always adamant that he would do everything he could to find her. He didn't care about the skeletons, you know, he was a little miffed, you know, it would rub him the wrong way, but he wasn't quiet.
But is there a chance, though, that the family, despite the search, despite the, you know, the website, that they may have come to the same conclusion as you, that Moore just wanted to leave, that couldn't handle the pressure of the family, pressure of the impending charges, which she thought were bigger than, certainly they were, but maybe she was in a certain psychological state to fake that somebody was missing, or pardon me, dead in her family, to stage that sort of comatose evening where she had apparently received a call from her sister. When you spoke to the sister, when other people spoke to the sister, police, she said it was no big deal. It was nothing out of the ordinary. Maybe Moore just wanted to take a night off. So could that explain why the family wasn't cooperative with you, and especially Fred, that maybe they just thought this worst thing too, that, you know, they weren't agreeing that she take off, but certainly maybe they concluded that she had.
I think that's the most logical explanation to that, that accounts for the behavior. I think so. I think, you know, I can't, you know, again, I can't say 100%, but that explains it logically to me. That would be an explanation for why they acted the way they did, and that they realized that Mora most likely took off, and they will, and she doesn't want anything to do with her family anymore. So, yeah, I think that's a possibility.
It's fascinating that we don't have enough time to really, and it's no way except if you read the book to really capture your adventure in this, because we really haven't even touched on the effect that this investigation has on you. And finally, I guess all of the work that you've ever done sort of catches up to you psychologically, but there are some things that are almost humorous in the danger that you put yourself in trying to interview people. I thought it was especially kind of humorous, but very, very vivid again, where you talk to Fred Jr. and he says that he wants to strangle you and he'd like to kick your ass, basically. So to say that people weren't cooperating with you in a lot of cases is an understatement, isn't it?
On this case, certainly, yes. And I was threatened numerous times, not just by the family, but, you know, other people, you know, witnesses or, you know, even people that got involved later on. You know, they're very antagonistic for some reason, but it's because I have to ask hard questions because I'd really like to know. I'd really like to know what happened to Mora. I would. I have an idea. I think it's a pretty good one. But I'd like to know for sure. I'd like to close this one. And in order to do that, you have to ask some uncomfortable questions, especially with families. So they were not so willing to answer or pleased with the questions. But I will say that when I finally managed to confront and speak to her sister Julie, I think Julie was really, really close to telling me something. And she wanted to. And I asked her, I said, tell me what Fred was really doing up there and at Amherst that weekend. What really happened that weekend before she went missing? What else am I missing? And Julie said, I could tell you. I could tell you exactly what happened. And her boyfriend at the time, who was also a lawyer, stepped in between and said, Julie, don't you say a word. Don't say anything more. And he shut her down. But I think Julie was close to telling me something, some bit of this.
Well, to be fair, too, what else would a lawyer advise? Do you think a lawyer would advise anything other than what he advised there?
Well,
right?
Of course, but that doesn't mean I can't be very disillusioned and disheartened that she, you know, she didn't anyway.
Sure.
At the end of the day, again, if this was a missing relative, brother, sister, whatever, I don't care what lawyers tell me. I'm going to give reporters and journalists and police, at least, every bit of information I can that may help them find her.
Now, the thing is, with this, we talked about the effect of social media, and social media had a big effect in your earlier case with Amy. What has been the effect of this book and this ongoing mystery and the amateur sleuth sort of movement that has evolved from that?
What exactly? I'm sorry. You want to know more about the effects of the social media
the effect of the book on the movement itself, on the mystery itself, on the debate itself. You say there's numerous people that have been contributing. So what has been the effect of now the release of the book and that information? What has that done to this movement?
It's interesting. Everything's kind of like in a standstill. So, you know, the blog itself, it generated a ton of interest in this case. And over the last just, you know, 3 years or so, there's been about 5 million views on the blog. And,
wow.
You know, each of these posts, you know, I'm looking, there were some days where I'd get 10,000 visitors. I mean, there were a lot of people interested in this, and it built and built and built. And, you know, new information was coming out, and there'd be weird twists, and eventually everything kind of led to this book. Now that the book's out, everybody's taken a moment to read it, and it's only been out for about 2 weeks now, and it definitely has an impact. Everything seems to kind of be in stasis. You know, now that all the info we have is basically out there for, you know, a new twist. We're looking for a new bit of information, and or maybe somebody that, you know, was hesitant to talk to me for the book, you know, maybe one of her close friends from high school, you know, somebody from that area or family member. Now that the book's done, now that it's out there and they see the lengths to which I went to try to find Mola, you know, perhaps they'll come forward and they'll finally speak and open up. But everybody's kind of waiting to see what happens next, and I don't know what that's going to be.
Now, throughout this, too, this is part memoir, this true crime book, and you had the great support of your wife, Julie, is it?
Yes, yeah. My wife's also named Julie.
Yes. Yes, and your young son. And you even took her along. It's very interesting. You took her along in your investigation because she could help you sort of smooth your way into certain interviews. So she was a very crucial person in this entire investigation and this book, wasn't she?
Of course, yeah, she was. And she, you know, I wouldn't have been able to devote as much time to this if she wasn't as understanding as she was. And, you know, to say she's understanding is one thing, but she's not, you know, she's, I will say this, she has not read the book. She won't read the book. She doesn't want to read the book because it's dark. It's too sad, and she doesn't want to go there. She kind of lived through most of it. And, you know, she was understanding that she knew that this was important to me, that this had become kind of an obsession, that this would eventually become a book, that this would eventually, you know, exist out there. But she wasn't happy about it. She wasn't happy that I would take off for a week to go looking for more in the White Mountains. Or trace down, you know, her family and friends who didn't want to talk to me, especially because, you know, we had this kid, you know, Casey, and, you know, he, you know, at the time I was really digging into this, he was about 4 or 5 years old, and, you know, he's got his own troubles, and then that's part of the book, too, is raising this kid who's beginning to show violent tendencies at age 4, while I'm trying to track down dangerous men in my job and the weird parallels I was seeing to, you know, my responsibility of raising a good man, you know, turning Casey into a good man so that he doesn't go out there and do harm. And he won't, you know, he's got a good heart. And it took us a while to figure out what was going on. And, you know, there were doctors that said he was on the autism spectrum, you know, Asperger's when they still use that name. And there's something unique and special about him. You know, he's highly functioning. He's brilliant in school, gets great grades, but behaviorally, you know, he's always had trouble. And, you know, he was lashing out and being violent with classmates and teachers and had to go to a special school for a couple of years because of that. And now he's, you know, fortunately back in public. So my life was very stressful, you know, when I was going through this search, and it was stressful for my wife because I'd have to, you know, take time away and go do these things to finish the book. And, you know, yes, she was very understanding, but she's very happy it's done. And one of the things that came of all this was, you know, kind of a promise that, you know, that this would be my last big case, you know, at least until the children are grown and out of the house, and for good reason. You know, there's some creepy people that gravitate towards these cases. There's a, you know, there are these internet trolls that come out that just want to cause anarchy and chaos on these blogs and discussion boards, and they act like they have information and lead you down, you know, rabbit holes and wild goose chases. And that, so most of it is harmless, but then there are the ones that, for instance, in this case, there is a troll that put pictures of Casey up on the internet and made a YouTube video of my son. And, you know, that was very scary. And I had conversations with prosecutors, and we were trying to get this guy put away, and it just didn't happen. And so he's still out there, and I have to, you know, make everything private. I had to switch everything on Facebook, and I had to unlist my phone number and address, and I had to, you know, basically become this, you know, hermit, and you know, that, you know, now I can understand why, you know, people like J.D. Salinger go into hiding. You know, it makes you want to cut ties with the human race when you run into people like that.
Yeah. We're going to have to wrap this up quickly, but I also wanted to mention one bright spot during this that really helped you have the money and also, more importantly, the time to be able to do this is Bradley Cooper's Silver Lining production company has optioned your book, Man from Primrose Lane. So that gave you a lot more breathing room, and congratulations on that, and hope to see that hit the
Thank
silver
you.
Screen. So for those that might want to contact you or find out more about your work, can you tell us about your webpage or website or Facebook? How might they do that, find out more about your work?
Yeah, really the best place for that is just jamesrenner.com. You'll find links to, you know, my Facebook page and Twitter accounts and the Maura Murray blog and Amy Mihalovic blog. And, everything kind of goes out from there. So jamesrenner, R-E-N-N-E-R, .com.
Well, I want to thank you very much, James, for coming on and talking about True Crime Addict, How I Lost Myself in the Mysterious Disappearance of Maura Murray. We just touched on some of this fascinating story. But thank you very much for coming on and talking about this incredible tale. Thank you.
Hey, thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks for being so in-depth with this, too. It's a fascinating case, and I hope it closes one day. I hope we get an answer.
Absolutely. It would be a fitting ending from all your work. Thank you very much. Good night.
Thank you. Thanks.